Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And basically, if you don't know how this works, we have no idea what album we're going to be listening to. So we are going to hit the button and just see what comes up and see what album we're going to be listening to. And this week, we're going to be listening to The Go-Go's Beauty and the Beast.
Interesting.
I don't know a whole lot about the Go-Go's.
No, I'm aware of them, but yeah, they kind of flew under my radar too.
They're part of that late 70s, early 80s new wave kind of thing. Let's see. Where's what album? Beauty and the... Oh, it's Beauty and the Beat, not Beauty and the Beast. Did I say Beauty and the Beast or Beauty and the Beat?
You said Beauty and the Beast because that's what it says
that's
on the thing.
That's what it says on the thing, but the name of the album is Beauty and the Beat.
Can we do this again? And the album we're reviewing is The Go-Go's Beauty and the Beat.
Beat. Not Beast.
Beat. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. Beauty and the Beat. Okay, so Beauty and the Beast, so this is their debut album. So the band The Go-Go's released in 1981 on IRS Records. I think IRS is... So IRS Records is a record company that had a lot of these like new wave bands, and it was started by Miles Copeland, who is the brother of Stuart Copeland from The Police. Miles Copeland was the manager of The Police as well as a lot of other bands.
Yep.
Including The Go-Go's, The Bangles, REM, Berlin,
The Cramps,
Dead Kennedys.
Okay, so they did punk a lot as well.
Yeah.
So.
So yeah, they're a prominent record label in that punk new wave era of the late 70s and early 80s. Okay, but this album, produced by Richard Goederer?
I'd say Goederer.
Goederer and Rob Freeman. In the late 1970s, Belinda Carlisle, Jane Weedlin and Margot Oliveria. There we go. I'm having trouble with names today. Met while attending punk rock shows in California. The three attended the Sex Pistols' final performance in San Francisco in January 1978. And they formed the band. So basically, this is their... This is their debut album, so this is like their, you know, it's their debut.
Yeah. And apparently when they formed their band, they didn't know how to play instruments, but they quickly learned.
Yes. as most punk bands do.
Yeah, that's the punk way.
Yeah.
Let's form a band. Sweet. Can you play? No.
No. Exactly.
Can you learn? Maybe.
Maybe. So the first song is, I think I know this song. I'm pretty sure you probably know this one too. It's called Our Lips Are Sealed. It's probably their biggest hit or one of their biggest hits.
It even says it's the single version.
The single version. here we go. This is the first song, Our Lips Are Sealed. Okay, short and sweet.
Yep.
I had heard that song a lot, but I never really listened to it. I think that's just a really well put together pop song. Mm-hmm. What I liked about it is, first of all, it's catchy as hell. It's simple, short, and it gets right to the point. And I like that little breakdown towards the middle there, where it kind of the rhythm kind of stops and it just changes up a little bit, so it keeps you interested in it. It's not the same thing the whole way through.
It's definitely a there's nothing complicated about it, but it's that's the point.
You don't need anything complicated. Nope. Sometimes you just, that's the thing that I always, a lot of musicians, I like musicians who can play well.
Yep.
But I think a lot of the time musicians and music geeks and people like that can get too caught up in judging a song by how difficult it is to play.
Yeah. That kind of bothers me more and more all the time. Too. Yeah. And I think we've talked about this before, but the fact that I know we've talked about it in terms of like say a guitarist. Like I can respect the talent and technique that goes into playing like Yngwie Malmsteen or something like that, but I'd much rather listen to ideally I'd like to listen to like a Stevie Ray Vaughan who has the chops, but he's got the feel to go with it.
Yeah.
But given the choice between the two, I'll take the feel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or someone like, it doesn't even have to be someone like, Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah,
who can like really rip, but someone who even plays really simple lines, like excuse me, like someone like Roger McGuinn,
right?
Who he's playing these like really like on the 12 string, obviously these really chimey, simple lines, but they're effective and. They get the point across.
Yeah.
You know? But, and then he does stuff like 8 Miles High where it is a little more complicated, but that's because the song calls for it.
Right.
You know? But, you know, getting back to this, I mean, this really, I think a lot of the new wave stuff is more of a callback to that like 60s pop stuff.
Right.
Cause I know we've talked about it before, but like progressive rock was really kind of starting to overstay its welcome at this point. And people wanted to go back to something that was a little more simple, a little more straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Every 10 years or so, rock and roll reinvents itself.
Yeah.
It's kind of what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so moving on to the next song. This one is called How Much More. Awesome. I love that song.
I like it better than the single.
Yeah. It was just like just so full of energy, and I like this song. I know it's a very common chord pattern going from the major down to the minor, but I always like that. The drums were really intense. The way that she was playing the toms, it was jangly, but it was powerful at the same time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's power pop right there is what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that. I really wish power pop would make a comeback.
Well, there's always bands that sort of keep it going.
Yeah. But I wish it would, you know,
become like another, well, you know, I think it might be due.
Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah.
Cause I think we need something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, like this really, harkens back to that 60s kind of sound, but it also has, I don't know. I mean, it has the elements of the 60s, but it also has like a punk attitude added into it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. But,
yeah.
That pretty much sums up what I'm thinking. Yeah. There's not much else to add to that.
I mean, yeah, there's,
a decent track.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. It's called
Just
Tonight.
Whipping through this one.
Just going right through it. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these songs are short pop songs, so there's like only a few things we can say, but I mean,
unless
that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that's just, you know, this is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we might like touch on like some musicality or a note or an influence that we pick up on, something like mm-hmm. that, just to sort of give us a guide of what we can possibly talk about as this goes on. I mean, we don't know what we're going to get necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the point of the whole podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, let's
number three.
Number three, Tonight. Another good song.
Yeah, I think I like that one even more than the last.
Yeah, one. And yeah. Well, this album just keeps getting better and better.
Yeah, and this song, you know what I heard?
What's that?
I heard REM. What I heard in this.
Yeah,
song. A lot of like a real REM sort of sound to it.
Which is interesting because this was a few years before mm-hmm. REM.
But so, it had that sort of jangle pop sort of sound to it. And even the way the song was written was very, I could almost hear Michael Stipe singing it.
Yeah, I know.
Or talking over it. Might be the case.
Yeah. Yeah. What I was thinking about in this, when I was listening to this is, you know, they mentioned that they formed the band after seeing the Sex Pistols play and mm-hmm. started playing in clubs. And, you know, I just, it's interesting to me how music scenes sort of form, because in the 70s, you think about punk rock as either being a British thing or a New York thing. And these guys were in LA, on the West Coast. Yeah. And I just never really thought about, the punk rock scene. I always thought it was isolated to either England or New York. There's this whole mythology of the punk rock of New York with CBGBs and that whole thing.
Yeah.
But you don't really think too much about the different scenes that were kind of happening throughout the whole country, I guess.
Of course. But then this is the same scene that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were part of, too. Like, they used to play the same gigs as a lot of these other groups.
Mm-hmm.
And L.A. usually has its own version of what you know, it's got its finger on the pulse of whatever scene's going on anywhere. It just seems to be, I mean, that's, you can't help it when that's where the record labels are located, or at least that was the case.
That's very true.
In the past century. I always got to wonder about nowadays, but I'm not entirely, I have a hard time getting my head around the,
well,
with the ones going on now. I'm such an old geezer now.
What? You mean record companies?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to decide whether they got their finger on the pulse or not, or whether they're just kind of calling the shots.
Well, the thing is, I don't think record companies are even relevant anymore.
Yeah, not really.
I mean, one of the biggest selling artists that has come out in the last few years is Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
And when she blew up, she didn't have a record deal.
That's right.
So I don't think record companies are relevant anymore. I think it's really more about discoverability online and really doing your own stuff.
Yeah, Bandcamp's got a more presence
Bandcamp and SoundCloud and places
at least
like
when it comes to stuff that people are actually listening to. When you turn on the radio, there still seems to be a lot of like industry, unless somebody is decided it's established, you never hear them.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's kind of always been the case.
Yeah.
Unless it's a local radio station or like an independent radio station that's playing, that you can somebody could submit.
Right.
But at that point, like, if I were an artist today, I probably wouldn't go that route because, you know.
Oh yeah, me neither.
You know, submitting my song to a radio station, I mean, is anybody going to hear it?
That's the thing. People will hear it when they're wandering around a store, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe when they turn on the radio because they don't really have any other means, depending on what they're driving, of listening to anything. But yeah. Yeah, it's a little, it's partly, it's just a major upheaval. I mean, it's just not, I don't know if anybody really knows what's 100% going on. Everybody has theories, but nobody's got, you know, solid evidence of anything really concrete. I mean, there's examples of every theory, but what's the general trend going on?
Yeah. I don't know if you ever saw, there was a video of Frank Zappa talking about how, I'm sure I must have mentioned it at some point or shown you or something, but he was talking about how, like, in the 60s, just the evolution of the record industry and how in the 60s, it was like the big, you know, conservative cigar chomping guys. And he was explaining that artists were actually better off with those guys running the show because they just said, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Put it out. See what happens.
Yeah.
So artists had more of a chance with the guys who didn't really know what was going on. And then, you know, it started in the 70s. They would get this, I think he explained how they would hire a guy with long hair. They wouldn't completely trust him, but they would hire him to get them coffee and to do little jobs here and there. And then they would slowly start to say, okay, well, what are you listening to? What do you like? And then it evolved into the A&R guys and then those guys kind of molding the artist to the way the industry is rather than the industry adapting to what the artists are doing.
Because now the execs sort of see themselves as an artist themselves. And whereas you think that wouldn't be, you think that would get you sympathy but instead it tends to, they have their own idea. So instead of being open to anybody else's idea, you kind of find yourself having to conform to their idea. And that sometimes, and you know, as I love artists, I can be an artist myself, right? I consider in some instances an artist myself. But a lot of artists have fairly large egos.
They can, yeah.
Having with a large ego comes with a lot of like opinions, and unfortunately with opinions comes, you know, kind of more a more rigid structure sometimes.
Well, I think the record executive guys are, I don't think they're necessarily artists. They want to be artists.
Yeah, exactly. They consider them.
They're frustrated.
They see
artists.
Themselves as an artist.
Yeah.
They see themselves as opposed to the record execs of the old days, were as scummy as they could be. They never claimed to have their finger on the pulse unless
right.
something was actually bringing in actual yeah. money. But these guys have their own idea, so. And yeah, they're raking in money, but they seem to have a more, they're calling shots that really aren't theirs to call.
Right. And there were probably guys that not only owned a record company, but probably owned other businesses too, and kind of left the artists alone to do whatever, because the record company probably wasn't their main concern. So
possibly.
They just kind of left it alone, and you let the artist do whatever they were going to do. And if it makes money, it makes money. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Well, a lot of these companies were like sub brands of like movie production companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, the big money makers probably was what was coming out of Hollywood. And actually a lot of them, like the record companies sprung out of that for basically the soundtracks of movies, which used to be major hits. When you go back to like the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s and occasionally later on. But yeah, when it became like its own music sort of going, branching off into its own direction, the record companies sort of became their own entities. And I think that might be partly also why it took a little bit longer, but whereas the older executives were sort of like, they were still holding on to the reins of both. Eventually they had the grip fell out of their hands.
Well,
companies into the hands of these other guys who had more rigid ideas of what they considered music.
Yeah. I think it really happened in the 70s
yeah.
when, 'cause the 70s was, that was the most successful the music business had ever been. That was when everybody was making money, like big, big money.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I think the executives realized how much money they could make. And I think since then they've been trying to grab onto that, by trying to curtail artists into being something they think that they can sell.
Exactly.
So I think that sort of the money that was being made in the 70s was sort of the catalyst to the executives shaping the music industry from then on.
Yeah, which is why
I could
the 70s
be wrong.
Was,
this is my that's my theory. I could be totally wrong.
Yeah,
but,
no,
you know.
But that sounds good. It makes sense because the 70s sort of being that middle ground, and there was that. You could almost sort of chart it out, whereas the early 70s was still very much in common with the 60s, whereas it's probably one of the most creative times in the music industry. And by the time the later 70s is rolling around, with maybe the exception of smaller labels such as the IRS label and other ones like that, it was largely, I mean, disco was a very manufactured genre. And yeah, and certainly into the 80s where they were trying to fit everybody into molds. Not that it killed all creativity, but it definitely killed a lot. And everything did sound very corporate and polished, and it really wasn't the best thing for music at the time. And people even said so at the time. I mean, there's a bit of a nostalgia for that sound now, but it's, again, it's sort of the rose-colored glasses effect and the nostalgia effect. And, you know, there's a legitimacy to that, too. I mean, you can take elements of these things and use them legitimately. Like, if you listen to something like Vaporwave or something like that, they take that corporate sound, but then filter it through, you know, it almost sounds like a deteriorating VHS tape or an old record or something like that. And it makes it interesting again.
It's like a lo-fi version
of a highly polished.
Yeah.
What's the word I'm looking for? Aesthetic.
Yeah.
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 Anyway, I digress.
Anyway, back from that tangent.
Yeah. And we thought we wouldn't have anything to talk about.
Right. So the next song that we have is called Lust to Love. All right. I kind of like that one. That was a bit darker.
Yep. That was another really good one. The songwriting quality was, that one's pretty high.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing that this is the debut album.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really feel like it.
No.
Like it doesn't feel like a band figuring it out.
It doesn't, oddly enough, it doesn't sound like a band that learned to play their instruments since the last time the Sex Pistols play, which was like 3 years before this came out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they learned what they were doing pretty quickly.
Gotta say.
Yeah. Yeah, I like this one. I like the production on this one. There was the first three, I feel, although I like it, they were everything was kind of in your face. Yeah. Whereas this one left a little more room. There was
a little bit spacier.
Yeah. There was a lot more reverb, I think, going on. And again, that's just, I think a lot of the time, producers, that's just a credit to the producer and the engineers, obviously. But a lot of the times I know this, that producers kind of get caught up in,
perfecting everything.
Not necessarily perfecting everything, but putting their own stamp on everything.
Yes.
And this is my sound.
Right.
Whereas a good producer will do whatever the song calls for.
Yes.
And I have to, I can't remember the name of the producer, Richard Gotterer, and Rob Freeman. I mean, these guys, I've never heard of them, but they are great producers because they are making choices that are right for the song, not necessarily what's right going to make a name for themselves.
Right. Right for the song, right for the band, right for, you know, whatever they're working with. They're not trying to, I mean, they're obviously have to mold it, but they're molding it into a shape that's sort of already kind of there. They're not trying to completely, you know, they're not taking a cow and twisting it into a pretzel.
Right.
they're saying, exactly. We've got a, let's, what are we presented with? A unicorn? Cool. We'll just make it a little bit more highly defined unicorn.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just a bit.
Right.
I'm just thinking of. Trying to think of a visual way of trying to represent what they're doing audibly.
Yeah. But I never really understood the combative nature sometimes that producers will have with artists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
unless, you know, the band says, we want you to turn the bass player down.
Well, there's that. But I never understood why like a producer will say no, we're play it this way, not that way. And I do understand that, but I don't understand fighting with the artist.
Right.
I've heard countless stories of producers fighting with the artist that they're supposed to be producing. Mm-hmm. And there's a way you may have a part in your head and it's perfect for the song and you're 100% right that the part that you have in your head is right for the song. And it's your job to get the guitar player or the drummer or whoever to play that part. Mm-hmm. There's a way that you can do that without being an asshole.
Generally.
You can be more, you can be persuasive and just make suggestions instead of dictating and saying, no, you play it this way. Like Phil Spector, pulling a gun on the Ramones, yes, and making them play the first chord to Rock and Roll High School for 8 hours straight makes no sense.
Yes, but this is Phil Spector.
Why would you do that?
No, I don't think a lot in Phil Spector's life made any sense past 1966. No. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's a true story, by the way.
I know.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, well, you the mean first, the audience, yeah.
Yeah, the first chord. The first chord, not even the whole song, not even playing the whole song
I would
over
leave
and over
and
for 8 hours.
Find another producer. I don't care how big Phil Spector is, and he was big, but I ain't putting up with that shit.
No. No.
What kind of punk band are you letting a geezer like Phil Spector push you around like that? He's got a gun. Yeah. Well, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
But when this hour's done, we're leaving.
If someone has a gun, you'll pretty much do whatever they say.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, I basically a roundabout way of saying the producers are doing this job. The producers are doing a really good job on this album by making choices that are for the song and not, you know, because they have a vision and, you know, it's their way or the highway.
Yep.
At least they're doing a good job of making it appear that way. I wasn't at the recording sessions. I don't know how it actually went down, but
right.
You know, at least it sounds that's what's happening.
It's pretty safe to assume that that the Ramones weren't cool with it.
No. No. I don't care who you are. If you pull a gun and make me play the same chord for 8 hours straight, I'm probably not going to be okay with you either.
No. Nope. Well, we're not hiring him again.
No.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on, the next song is called This Town. Here we go. Cool. Another great song.
Yeah, that's another really good one. I like the time signature in it, too.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out what that actually was, but it would seem they skip a bar or something.
Yeah. I think it's still 4/4, but they're just kind of playing around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I don't mean this to sound bad, but I don't think they were advanced enough in their playing to play around with different time signatures.
But they kind of did anyway.
Maybe they did. I think it is still 4/4. I'll have to go back and listen to it again.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
It's a little bit different, but yeah, they're sort of...
Yeah.
Jumping. It's almost like a 6... Or it's not a 6/4, but it's almost like a, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't trying to figure it out.
Yeah. It works though.
And it had that really cool twangy thing. It's almost like an old Duane Eddy tune or something when it started up. It was cool.
Yeah. I thought that the guitar tone is that a Gretsch?
Yeah, it sounded like it might have been something like that. If not, then they played with whatever they were using to sort of get a Gretschy tone, I think. I think one of the other songs before, which I think was Tonight, which had that almost like a Rickenbackery tone, but I don't even think they were using a 12 string. They just had that tone applied to it somehow.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah. So. They're definitely pulling things out of the 60s, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know. And this was the beginning of, it seems like every 20 years there's a nostalgia for 20 years before.
Yeah, it's usually.
Like there was nostalgia, there was big nostalgia for the 50s and the 70s and 60s and the 80s, 70s and the 90s. It was...
There's an affection for the 90s now, I've noticed. And
yeah.
Some places.
Although it's starting to get more into...
people are talking 2000s. The early 2000s. Yeah. And I look at that and I'm like, but that was just... Yeah, but
so, yeah.
It was 20 years ago.
No, it wasn't just. It
was... exactly.
Yeah. We're just old and time's going by too fast.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I, again, this song is a bit different in that it leaves a lot of space, but in a different way than Lust to Love.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's cool. Obviously, they're singing about Los Angeles, and
I've noticed that with every, I mean, we started off with the single and isn't this the way it goes? The simplest song was the one that started us off, but with every successive song so far, they've introduced a different element. They've just added and then another element and then another element and the songs are getting a little bit more sophisticated as we go through the album.
Yeah.
At least halfway through the album, that seems to be the case.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's usually, you know, look, Miles Copeland, he was a champion of independent bands, getting their recognition, but he was also a really good manager and he knew how to sell a band, but he knew how to sell a band as they were.
Right.
He didn't try to mold them like we were talking about earlier. He took a band and saw what they were doing and knew how to sell that rather than trying to change the band to be able to sell them. He was really good at seeing bands for who they were. I mean, he managed the Police and a lot of those punk bands, and you know, especially what was it? Dead Kennedys?
Yeah. Dead Kennedys and the Cramps, which are another really great punk bands from the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. There's no way you're going to tell them what to do.
No.
So
Dead Kennedys, for sure.
Yeah.
That's their shtick.
Yeah.
We exactly. Get in front of a microphone and we tell you what's what.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, so he's really good at selling, selling bands that knew, forgot what I was saying. He's good at selling bands for who they were.
Yeah.
So basically unlike what I'm saying is he knew to put the that out as a single. Yeah. And he knew that that would, they probably wrote the song.
Yeah.
Not intending it to sell, but he heard the song and saying, I know I can sell this.
Yeah.
So he's really smart that way. It's like, okay, I can see what the band is doing and I know what to present to the world.
Yeah. And it just gets me on another tangent about some of the other, producers at the time where, you know, they talk about, oh, we got this band, Heart from, you remember them from the 70s, Barracuda and stuff like that? Oh, yeah, I think I remember. So do they play synthesizers? I guess so, yeah. Says the manager.
Yeah.
Go to the band. You okay, you play synthesizers now because I told this guy you did. Yeah. What?
I could just see, well, I could see that, or just I can see a guy just ripping a line of cocaine.
Yeah.
And going,
okay.
You know how you guys are a really good guitar band?
Yeah.
Fuck all that.
We're gonna put you on a tether, and we're gonna make you fly through flames.
Yeah,
and it'll be great. It'll be great. Great.
Yeah. Yeah, we're gonna make a shitload of money. We're gonna be rich, man. Yeah.
Smoke machines. More smoke machines.
Yeah.
Bubbles. What happened to the bubble machines from the Lawrence Welk show? What did he do with those? He's still using them? Damn it.
Get Welk on the horn. I need his bubble machine.
Yeah. All right.
Anyway, the next song is actually another single, but this is the beginning of side two, so I wonder if side two will follow the same pattern.
We'll see.
This is probably the biggest hit that they had. Either Our Lips Are Sealed or We Got the Beat are the biggest two hits, I think. So here we go. That was... that reminded me of like early Beach Boys.
I can sort of hear that. It's partly because of the, interesting. I will say, I think that's a stronger single than the, mm-hmm. than the other one. It's just got a much, much stronger hook. And it's, I don't know which one was more successful. I think it's probably gotta be this one.
I think this one, I think this was the first single actually.
Mm.
Although the other one was the first song on the album, this was the first single. I would agree. I think this one is a stronger single. And it has a, like you said, it has a stronger hook. It has that breakdown in the middle where it's just mm-hmm. the drums and the hand claps and they're like chanting it, which would work really well, probably at their live shows.
Yeah. That's it. I also have noticed that they put their singles as the first track on either side, which is it's a pretty interesting, and I think it's a pretty smart, that's a marketing move. It's almost like they could sell the record as a single and people don't have to worry about trying to search, place the needle right on the spot on the record where the single starts. They can go right to their most likely favorite song is because mm-hmm. it's right there at the beginning of the record or the side.
Yep. I never thought about that, but yeah, that's a really, mm-hmm. really smart thing to do.
Plus, they get all this other bonus stuff. I mean, they're paying for it. They were paying full record price for it, obviously.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah, maybe it was some of the guitar stuff that reminded me of like early Beach Boys.
Maybe.
Kind of that surf rock kind of thing.
Maybe. But I always considered, like, I always thought, think more of like the Ventures and things like that when I think surf rock. I mean...
Yeah.
The Beach Boys didn't sound like, I mean, they had more of that beach, like sort of surf theme, but it wasn't surf rock, if you know what I mean. It wasn't really that guitar based. Most of surf rock was pretty instrumental. If there is any vocalizations, it was hoops and hollers.
Like, yeah.
Wipeout or something like that.
Tequila.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Beach Boys was at least more along the lines of like Jan and Dean and other people like that. They obviously branched out later after the Beatles started to become more serious.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Wilson went, I kind of want to do proper, you know, write more intricate and interesting stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another topic for another day.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get to that when we do.
Yeah.
That sounds.
You thought you were going to get another tangent. Not this time.
No, we stopped ourselves.
control.
Yeah. But yeah, I think this is, I mean, I like the other single too. I mean, it's not a bad song, but I think this is better. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do you think, if you were sequencing the album, would you start this song off, start the album with this song rather than the other one?
Would you swap
the two?
The way I like to listen to an album, I don't like to use all the best stuff right at the beginning of the album. One thing that actually kind of bothers me about a lot of albums sometimes is when they kind of run out of gas with the further along you get into them. And even there's some really great albums, but they start to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily the stuff is bad, but you kind of feel a little tired at the end of it. So yeah. I don't know. I think they placed this pretty much, especially considering they wanted to put the singles at the beginning of both sides, putting the best of them on side two, you know, especially for an album listener after they listen through all that and the gradual progression of everything getting better and better. You flip the record over, there's the big hit of the better of the two, mm-hmm. for sure. So I might have placed it exactly where it is, to be perfectly honest, if I'm thinking fair like enough. That. So
Yeah, that's fair. No, I was just curious if you would make that choice. Yeah.
I don't think about that very often. Usually I kind of accept an album as it is. But,
as it is, yeah.
But as I've explained, sometimes I've noticed a record will run out of gas when it gets to the end. So it's like, well, you should have topped that tank off a little bit more or you know, conserved your gas along certain highways there instead of just pedal to the metal until you're running on fumes towards the end.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. It's called Fading Fast.
All right.
That was a pretty good song.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. I don't know if it was as high quality as some of the stuff we've heard before, but you can definitely tell that they've kept a lot of the elements that they picked up on as they've gone through the album. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to call it this, but it's almost like just a bit of a drop, but it's not down quite as far as like say the beginning was or as rudimentary as the beginning was. There's other things going on, so it's still pretty decent.
Yeah, I think maybe what happened here, I could be wrong, but I think what it sounds like is, I think they were, the music is a little more interesting, or at least I think they're attempting to play something that's a little more complex, but I don't think they have the experience yet to quite pull it off.
Mm, maybe. This is also something you can make up with like, you know, several different takes in the studio too.
Yeah.
So, you know, and after you've done like 25 takes of a song, you usually can play it pretty well.
Well, I'm not talking about the playing. I'm talking about the right, like coming up with the different parts.
Yeah,
it's like, it sounds like they're not quite sure of themselves yet. You know what I mean? Like they don't quite have the experience of
maybe
coming up with different parts. It sounds like they're trying to get there, but they're not quite
there.
Hitting the bullseye.
Yeah, it's still not bad though.
I'm not saying it's bad. It's a good song. that I don't know if it was the guitar or the synthesizer doing that.
Outro thing, the beep beep
yeah,
beep, beep beep.
But it was going throughout the whole song,
right?
And it just kind of gave it this sort of rhythm.
I think it might be. I heard something like an old combo organ. Mm-hmm. It's the earlier in the album. It might have even been that.
It could be
something like that.
One of the things that I do that I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing that I do, but when I listen to a song, sometimes I'll take on the role of the producer and find things that I would do differently. And one of the things that I would do differently in this is I would have the drummer play more fills. It sounds like she was just mostly just playing the beat. And with a song like this, a faster song, that makes sense. You want to keep that steady beat. But a song like this, you want to do something a little more interesting than just that.
That would have helped the song, yeah. I think you're right. That would have added just that extra little bit of interest in places that it seemed to want it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can even hear it in my head. And I kind of do the same thing. And a lot of times I hear something and go, oh, it's sort of missing. But I always think myself more as a musician in the room.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I'd be getting behind the drums or getting at the keyboard and going, play it like this.
Yeah.
But then again, a lot of producers do that too.
Yeah, they do.
And we were just talking about how that's not necessarily what you want them to do.
Exactly.
So, but yeah. I do that on my own stuff for sure.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. This next one is called Automatic. I like it when bands aren't afraid to get a little weird.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, that was a good one. I think that's the only song on the album so far that had a fade out too.
Yeah. Well, there was one. I think the second or third song had a fade out.
I might have just not noticed. I guess fade outs were kind of common. I don't always hear them.
Yeah. No, I know.
This is another song where it sounded a bit like an REM deep track, a little bit at times. Not all the time, but at times.
Yeah. It was a little bit psychedelic. Had some of those elements in there. And I like that it's... I was kind of... Not concerned, but... I guess my expectation, because I knew the two songs, that they were all just going to be like the same kind of
balls pop, to the wall punk
pop song. Yeah. Pop punk songs. But I'm pleasantly surprised that that's not the case, that they, you know, went a little deeper and actually wrote some interesting stuff. And I like that this, this song, you know, you can tell usually when, with a band's, debut album, you can hear their influences and they wear their influences on their sleeves. And, you know, as they progress in their career, they sort of find their own thing.
Yeah.
It seems like they, you know, you can definitely hear the influences of a lot of 60s stuff, but they're also pretty early on finding their own sound.
Yeah.
You know, which is, like I said, this doesn't feel like it, in that respect, it doesn't feel like a debut album. It feels like, and I wonder if because they started the band before they could play instruments, that helped with that. That they, they kind of went in fresh and not having, you know, played for 10 years on their own learning, you know, covers. They just kind of went in started a band and started, they probably played some covers, but, you know, quickly started writing their own songs.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, some people really do seem to have, like, this inherent talent that, you know, they pick it up, pick up the instrument, and they can sort of figure things out much quicker than a lot of other people do. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's sometimes that's the way it is.
Yeah.
This is not to dissuade anybody who, you know, wants, most people don't do that. Okay.
No, it's rare.
It's rare.
Yeah.
I did to a certain degree, to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a bit of a slog trying to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did pick up things pretty quick mm-hmm. when it came to initial playing and stuff like that. But so I can see both sides, and I really don't want to discourage anybody who wants to pick up an instrument and say, oh, but they're able to pick up an instrument and they already know how to play it. And it's like, no, that's not how it goes.
No, most people don't.
No,
don't go do that. No, most people, you know, start with E and then A, back to E, you know, that's, and most people start off learning covers. Like, most people don't.
Yeah, right.
It's rare when someone learns to play guitar and then immediately starts writing their own stuff, and it's good. Like, that.
Not everybody's the Shags. Of course, the Shags are a little weird, too.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, I like that this song. My image of this doesn't sound like what I think of when I think of the Go-Go's, but it also doesn't really sound like anybody else. It's kind of its own thing.
Right.
Like you said, it has elements of, it could be an REM deep cut, but, this was 3 or 4 years before REM's first album came out. So,
yeah, I think so. They had some, like, I think they had like some tapes out, but I don't think they weren't big or anything like that. I don't think there was really much of an influence until they start putting out stuff towards the mid to late 80s. But I think they even had, I think their first EP, whatever you call it, was like basically just a combination of songs that they kind of just stuck together on whatever. And I think it came out in maybe even the late 70s, but I don't remember exactly. They were around for a little while anyway. I can't remember what their timeline's like.
No, but I mean, the point is, like, they were influenced by the Go-Go's.
Wouldn't
be surprising.
I think they were in similar circles.
Yeah.
So that might be part of it. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on to the next one. It's called You Can't Walk in Your Sleep If You Can't Sleep, which is true.
Very logical, astute observation. Very abrupt ending.
That was a very abrupt ending. That was an all right song. It was honestly kind of a throwaway.
A little bit.
You know.
It's not a bad song. It's just not the strongest on the album. I did like that surf guitar-ish solo in the middle. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was cool. Other than that, I think it was, I would say it's on the same level as the first song in terms of quality. It's not a bad song. It's just a simple, catchy pop song.
Right.
It's not my favorite, but not a bad song either.
Yep.
That's what I'll say about it.
Not my favorite song. Probably wouldn't skip it.
No.
It's not bad enough to skip.
No, exactly. That's really all I have to say about it. So moving on to the next one, we've got two songs left. The second to last is called Skid Marks on My Heart.
That was, boy, nothing gets me going like girls singing about cars. And then with another surf guitar solo in the middle.
Woo! Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty decent song, actually.
That
thing was better than the last one.
That should have been a single, I think.
It could have been a single.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely better than the last one. Yeah. I don't know, there's just something about it. It had more...
energy.
I want to say, well, yeah, I guess it did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, like, there's nothing more much I can say about it. It's a like pop rock song, mm-hmm. like the last one, but it's just, I don't know. Maybe it's, I really don't know what's different about it. Like, I can't put into words why I like this one better than the last one.
It's the undescribable other thing.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. It's just like, well, that one's clearly better. Can't really pinpoint why. It's just is.
It just is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe it is. Maybe maybe it is more energy. Maybe the drums are a little faster. Maybe the guitar. I really don't know. The bass line
was doing a little more in there.
That
might have been part of it.
Yeah. Maybe more interesting things going on.
The rhythm section's making your butt wiggle.
That's probably it. That's probably it. All right. So now we've arrived at the last song, and it is called Can't Stop the World.
That's a pretty strong closer.
That is a very strong closer.
Yeah.
That was maybe one of my favorites on the album, actually.
It might be. Yeah. The
just
it's a bit of a good closing ethos. Can't stop the world, so why let it stop you?
Exactly.
Yeah. Something I need to remind myself of sometimes.
a good song with a good message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And more really great guitar playing. Great guitar tones, great guitar playing in it.
Yep. And a catchy melody.
Very catchy. Yep. That was very, very solid closer to this album.
Yeah.
It's, I see why it's on the list. It's a pretty good one.
Yeah. Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised by this album.
Mm-hmm. Dim some badass ladies.
Yeah. I was... Because I knew some of the singles. I'd obviously heard them before. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you have too.
I certainly heard that the We Got the Beat. I've heard it before. Not often, but I had heard it before.
Yeah. I think other than those two songs, maybe a few others from a later album, I never really paid much attention to the Go-Go's. Mm-hmm. And I hate the comparison between the two because it's a record industry thing to sell records, and it's a macho thing. But there was
probably
a rivalry.
Sexist.
It was probably sexist. I think it was a manufactured rivalry between the Go-Go's and the Bangles because they're two very similar bands who had a 60s pop.
Right.
Sound. And so I knew the Bangles because I was more familiar with their music because I think I was introduced to them because they sang backup on a Tom Petty song.
I think they did it
Waiting
on a couple
for Tonight.
Things. Yeah. They did a couple things with them, I think, around that period.
So I knew them, and so I sort of listened, I was introduced to them that way, and I knew a lot of their music. And maybe I had subconsciously bought into the rivalry because I kind of maybe dismissed the Go-Go's a little bit because of that. I was like maybe choosing sides.
Sometimes subconsciously you do that, but then sometimes it's, I know nothing about it, but nothing introduced you. Sometimes it doesn't matter. Like, something just doesn't get introduced to you for whatever reason. It's just you're always circling around. And I mean, it's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
So it might not have been that at all. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't even know anything about the real rivalry or anything. I think it wasn't even a rivalry.
No, there wasn't. I don't think they even really knew each other, to be honest. But it was just a music industry thing to sell records and magazines and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and they never do that now.
No, of course not.
No.
Because I'm more familiar with the Bangles than the Go-Go's, I guess in my mind kind of split them off and sort of dismissed them, but I'm glad that I listened to this and sort of and pleasantly surprised and I'm probably going to listen to them more now.
Yeah, they're worth going through their discography. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Worth checking out for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this album for sure. It's a win.
Yeah. Yeah. And we keep doing this. We keep going. I don't know about you, but I go into, you know, an album will pop up and I have an idea in my head of what the band is based on the few songs that I hear.
Yeah.
And then I listen to the album. It's like, oh, this is actually interesting. This is actually, there's more going on than I thought there was.
Yeah. It's, you kind of do that, but part of that is the compartmentalization. That's me slapping my face so I can speak properly. I do that sometimes. compartmentalizing. Sometimes your brain does that just to reduce the overflow of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're digging through albums and you go into, I don't know, a record store and you flip through, oh, I got to go through the R's and then the S's and flip, 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 flip.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to walk home with the whole damn stack. There's things that your brain has to like divide things up into to things that you really want to pick out. And in doing that, unfortunately, you wind up writing off some stuff just because, well, not even writing it off. There's only so much money. You can't buy that album.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about it. It's a bit of a risk.
Exactly. So, yeah. Well, going back further to our first episode, like when we did the U2 album,
mm-hmm.
I liked U2, but I just thought, well, you know, that's not really my thing. Listening to the album, it's like, oh, this is my thing.
I'd heard more of them and I've always liked Sunday Bloody Sunday. I always thought that song was great.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the albums were necessarily kicking around my house. I mean, there was just other stuff, and it's not because there was anything against them. It's just other stuff took priority. That's the best way to describe it. Yeah. Other stuff took priority.
Yeah.
So that's why this sort of experimentation is useful, because it's digging up the stuff that didn't take priority.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm... because of that, I know I keep saying this, but it's true. I mean, I'm glad we're doing this, and I'm glad that I'm discovering music. If an artist comes up that I've never heard of before, that's one thing. But I think it's breaking my
preconceived notions.
Of artists, I think it's more exciting than discovering an artist that I never heard of.
Yeah, sometimes.
You know.
Although I still like finding artists that I've never heard of and then being pleasantly surprised and find, ooh, that guy's cool, or that girl's cool, or these girls are cool, in the case of this band.
But having a paradigm shift of an artist is fun.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And Anyway, I don't have anything to say. Did you want to?
No, I think we pretty much like I said earlier, it's just like we always find something to talk about when it comes to these things. Even when we go in first, well, that song was cool. What's the next one like? I guess that one's kind of cool too.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Are we gonna have anything to say about this? Eventually, yes, we have things to say about it.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you for listening if you made it this far. And you can drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. You can check us out at polyphonicpress.com. And if you want to help out the show, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/polyphonicpress. And that's about it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
Yeah, I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.